groups like the KKK and names like David Duke are in the headlines again after the violence in Charlottesville shocked the nation, and as there are continued threats of white supremacist rallies to be held around the country, many are wondering how to respond to this new rise in far-right fanaticism.
Well, one professor says the answer is simple: laughter. The show's Lauren Gilger spoke with him more about this and is here to explain. Lauren, what's the idea here? How can we laugh off something that's so serious?
Right. Well, this isn't about ignoring the problem. Instead, it's about the power of satire. Penn State Media Studies professor Kevin Hagopian says all we need to do today is to look to a great American icon of comedy, Charlie Chaplin, and a film he made as Hitler and the Nazis were on the rise in Europe called The Great Dictator.
How wonderful. Tolmania, a nation of blue-eyed blondes.
Why not a blonde Europe, a blonde Asia, a blonde America?
A blonde world.
And a brunette dictator.
Dictator of the world.
Why not?
Hilfen Sie! Der Wiener Schnitzel mit der Lagerwirten und der Sauerkraut! Hey, der Pilten sagt der Pilten!
As far as I'm concerned, I want to make this very simple. This is the treaty. You agree not to invade Austerlitz, I agree not to invade Austerlitz. We sign the treaty, then I remove my troops from the border.
Good. In other words, when your troops are off the border, I sign.
That's all right.
Very good.
The film skewers Hitler and calls into question the cult of personality that was being built around him in the 1930s. I spoke with Hagopian more about the film and the ways in which satire can play a role again today.
Well, that film came out in 1940, so it's at a remarkable sort of frozen moment in the history of movies and world culture, because it is after World War II starts, which happens in late 1939, but before the U.S. is formally in the war, which happens in late 1941. And Chaplin was a very political individual. He was aware of some of what was going on in Germany at the time. So he wanted to use not just the movies as a bully pulpit to speak against that kind of systematic maltreatment and to raise awareness of it around the world. He also understood that he, Charlie Chaplin, was in a position even more unique than most movie makers are. You know, most movie makers have the attention of a lot of the world. Charlie Chaplin had the attention of all of the world. He knew that whatever he said and did in movie form would be counted upon not only to sell a lot of tickets, but also would in and of itself be news. And that's exactly what The Great Dictator turned out to be, both a very popular film and a kind of public, a public event as well. A news event.
Right. So in the movie, he's essentially spoofing Hitler, right? This is pure satire.
It is. And he plays a character who is a lowly, poor Jewish barber in a mythical country that's clearly intended to be Germany, a version of Germany. Well, it turns out that by coincidence, he's an exact double for the crazy, deeply prejudiced and hypocritical and vain dictator of that country. And just in case, you know, audiences didn't get the connection, not only is Chaplin dressed like Hitler, but his name in the film as the dictator is Adenoid Hinkel. So in the course of the movie, the little barber who happens to look exactly like this dictator becomes drawn to be mistaken for the dictator. But finally, at the end of the movie, there's the opportunity or the responsibility for this impersonator to give a speech as the dictator. And he knows that this will be the moment at which people realize that he's not really Hinkel. And so in a very famous and very serious conclusion to the film, Chaplin speaks essentially as Charlie Chaplin to the world about the need for tolerance and the need for understanding. And he does it by looking directly into the camera.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone.
So I wonder, if we took Charlie Chaplin and making fun of the Nazis, right? Did those things really affect the situation? Did it kind of unite people against or raise awareness of what was happening in Germany at the time?
What I think is interesting is that the film was banned in Germany, which suggests that the Nazi leadership felt that there was at least a danger that this kind of humor would call into question the seriousness of Hitler's program, that it would certainly lead to people noticing things about Hitler's presentation that had the possibility of being understood comically. And once you do that, once you reveal that, you know, the emperor is unclothed, in a regime that depended as much on faith and emotion as the Nazis did, you've introduced a potentially very subversive element into the way the public understands you.
Yeah. And so I want to talk a little bit more about today. So, I mean, we see satire in politics all the time now and always have. But I wonder, do you think that it still can fill the same role as we sort of see this rise in white supremacy and this new movement that is coming out of the shadows a little bit?
There may be a new and expanded role for political satire, which is some of the best satirists, certainly on the left and perhaps on the right as well, see the satirical role to be more closely tied to the role of education and information. You know, it's very commonplace now in light of the reduced news window that so-called political satire shows, you know, John Oliver is a classic example, but so is The Daily Show, are functioning as a combination of satire and information. They're not just making fun of or mocking the far right. They're also presenting in a humorous vein some pretty thick news stories.
There are big differences, though, between what was happening in 1940 yeah. America and what's happening now. I mean, one in the sense that the people on the far right are here in America. This is not some
yes.
leader on the other side of the ocean, right? How does that change it? And does that make satire more or less useful here?
Well, during the late 1930s, there was not just a significant far-right presence here in the U.S. Did they number in the millions? No, they didn't. Neither do the most active and most violent of the white supremacist groups now. The neo-Nazi groups who are branding themselves as such in the U.S. today, I think in some ways that is itself a form of satire. And by that I mean that to affiliate with the Nazis, if you were a person here in the U.S. back in the late 1930s, was a lot more naive than it is today, right? Because the full details of the Nazis' depredations were not making it into the consciousness of ordinary American citizens. Now we know. So that when anyone, however they feel, whatever their political opinions are, when they consciously borrow the iconography, that is, the symbols, the verbiage of Nazism, they're doing so knowingly. And one of the main reasons they do it is to irritate people, to be transgressive, to show their opponents that they're not willing to follow the rules of ordinary civilized discourse. I mean, it's bad enough to call someone a Nazi. In a way, it's even stranger and a greater act of theater to call yourself a Nazi. So that suggests to me that a useful response to one kind of theater is another kind of theater, the theater of political satire.
So later on in life, though, Chaplin said that if he had known the extent of what Hitler was capable of carrying out, he wouldn't have done it. He wouldn't have made fun of him because it wasn't funny. So are we walking too fine a line here?
That's a great question. And I think the concern is that by joking about the far right, we will create a climate in which ordinary viewers and listeners and readers will begin to understand all politics as no longer meaningful, but strictly theater, that none of it matters, quote unquote, and that in and of itself will create a space in which, through neglect, these kinds of extreme political actors can simply take over the institutions of civil government and citizenship and remake them, you know, in their own image. To some extent, that's what happened in Germany. People in the middle of the political spectrum, many of them, could not imagine that a figure as transgressive and so different from other political figures as Hitler could possibly find his way to power. And he did.
Kevin Hagopian is a senior lecturer of media studies in the College of Communications at Penn State University. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us to talk about this.
I'm very happy to be here.